The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Friday, the 17th of August, 2018. On the podcast today, I have Simon Cole, Chief Executive Officer of 7digital, 7DIG, the ticker there. And Simon goes over the highlights from their final results and the outlook going forward too. Also on the podcast, Aidan Bishop, founder and chairman of Big Dish. Dish is the ticker there. And Aidan discusses the acquisition of Lulu, a web and app-based restaurant and travel discovery business focused in the Philippines. Plus, I have Simon Stillwell, CEO of Bonhill Group, that's B-O-N-H. And Simon talks about the acquisition of Investment News for a total consideration of $27.1 million and a placing to raise approximately $19.4 million and its admission to trading on AIM. Plus, I have Ross Mould talking about global economic issues like Trump, China, Turkey, and the possibility of a global economic slowdown. Plus, he covers the following stocks: Pressure Technologies, Stock Spirits, and Truffin. I also have on John Mayer, mining analyst and partner at SP Angel. And John talks about vanadium and Bushveld Minerals, BMN. And as always, I have the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours and the top five most liked RNSs. But check out the front page of voxmarkets.co.uk and you'll see them there because they're always changing.
Vox Markets is an online community of investors that runs a free mobile and desktop platform that allows you to track news and updates about any UK-listed company, offering RNS push notifications, detailed charts, pricing data, and much more. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Simon Cole, Chief Executive Officer of 7digital. 7DIG is the ticker there. Simon, thanks for joining me again.
Nice to speak to you again, Justin.
Now, you've had your preliminary results out for the year ended 31st December, and I'm seeing a lot of growth there. We'll go into the detail in a bit. Before we do, Simon, if someone's listening, they're not familiar with the company, how would you summarise 7digital for them, please?
7digital is the company that is that owns the picks and shovels for the growing streaming music business, by which I mean we're a platform on which customers can build streamed music services. A lot of people think the streaming music industry is mature. They think Spotify and Apple is it. In fact, there's 160 million people subscribing for $9.99 a month services. There's 3 billion people listening to music another way. So the real growth in streamed music is wireless loudspeakers, connected cars, retailers who want to compete with Amazon. They were offering people free music with their loyalty card scheme, etc., etc. The streaming music industry is going to grow substantially in the next 3 years. That growth is going to come from the mass market, not from the people who pay £120 a year for music. And the mass market wants its music bundled with other things, whether it's a phone, a car, a wireless loudspeaker. When companies want to bundle music, they need a platform that can deliver that streamed music for them, and that's us.
Excellent stuff.
Great example of that, actually, and you know, shows through in these numbers, is our largest customer that we won last week, MediaMarkt Saturn, biggest retailer in Europe of electronics and entertainment. They are simply gunning for Amazon. So we're building a streamed music service for them in 15 countries. We've launched in 3 already. They'll be offering music free to their loyalty card holders. They'll be offering music in their stores bundled with devices, et cetera, et cetera. That's a great example of the kind of customer that we're seeing coming to the platform.
That was the best one-minute summary I've ever heard in my life. You can tell you're in radio, sir. You can tell you're a radio guy. You can talk. Let's break it down to your operational highlights and then financial results. So let's go into the operational highlights first, Simon, if you could.
The operational highlights really are all about growth. And today, because our results are delayed, we're disclosing today both our results for 2017, but also the results for the first half of 2018. 2017 showed a 50% increase on 2016 in turnover, and the first half of 2018 shows a 54% growth. This is a very steep growth curve. The most significant thing, though, is that growth is coming from our licensing revenue. Licensing is the fees we charge people for access to that platform, people like MediaMarkt Saturn. We've seen a 74% increase in our licensing revenues. Our licensing revenues deliver 90% margin. That increase explains why our gross margin is up from 59% 3 years ago to 72% today. We promised investors 3 years ago we'd get that margin to 75. We're in touching distance of that. All of that growth in turnover goes through to the bottom line because of that high margin, which is why EBITDA is down 63%. Our EBITDA losses were 4.3 million in 16. They're 1.6 million in 17. And actually, if you do the maths, in the second half of 17, we were profitable at that level. Adjusted operating losses, and that the only thing we adjust is we take out non-recurring costs like the cost of acquisition last year. They're down from 4.3 million losses to 1.6. That's a 33% reduction. So all of the indices are heading in one direction, which is towards profitability and cash flow positivity. And actually, we are weeks away from that. We will be there by the end of this period, by the end of 2018.
So, do you know what? I was just going to ask you. I was going to say exactly. I mean, listen, you know, results are a historical document. They're like months ago and 8 months ago now. Yeah. Seven. But what's it like going forward? And you are suggesting that this momentum is carrying on. Is that right?
The momentum is definitely carrying on, both in terms of customer wins over the coming days, you will see some customer wins that we will be disclosing. We're in discussion with a lot of large companies, global companies, some retailers, for example, who want to replicate what MediaMarkt Saturn are doing. But yeah, I mean, you can see from the first half number, which is 53% up in revenues, you know, our revenues in the first half of the year are touching 10 million. You know, the estimate for revenues for the whole of this year is 22 million. So we're well on course to get to the revenues we need for this year. And with that gross margin of 72%, you know, 72 pence in every pound of growth is going to the bottom line. We also, in the next few weeks, though, will begin to take some costs out of the business, which we're doing as a result of the consolidation of our platforms. We made an acquisition last year of one of our competitors in Europe, a company called 24/7. We've been working hard to consolidate our technology platforms, and when we do that, that will reduce the costs of the business because, for example, we won't be ingesting music in two sites, we'll be ingesting it in one site. So our technology costs will go down. The rising turnover pushes the bottom line up anyway. So we've got a dual two factors pushing the bottom line to positivity over the coming weeks.
Yeah, do you know what, Simon? Listen, the figures are looking good, the operation is improving, but what I like most is you can hear your enthusiasm and passion for the business in your voice, you know?
Well, I set out 4 years ago to do some things with this business. When we created the new Seven Digital in 2014, we said that what we would do is we would consolidate the marketplace because it was a messy marketplace of small companies doing what we do, and that we would see big growth because the streaming music industry was going to grow exponentially. Both of those things are happening. That makes me very enthusiastic. We've consolidated the market. We've acquired our two major competitors over the last 18 months, Snow White in France, 24/7 in Copenhagen, and we are seeing that growth. We're also seeing the beginnings of the big customers that will make a difference in this business. MediaMarkt Saturn are an example of the kind of customer that we are winning now. You know, they'll spend 6 million euros with us this year. There are other large retailers in the world who need to compete with Amazon and therefore need music services. You know, just one example, Walmart in the US has no digital music offering. So its customers don't get anything with their loyalty card, whereas Amazon Prime customers get free music. It's not rocket science to work out that Walmart need to do something about that, and I would like to hope it'll be us they do it. So I'm enthusiastic because we're seeing the things happening that we had expected to happen, and that always makes one feel good.
Excellent stuff. Well, one last thing, Simon. If someone's listening to this, likes the sound of your passion, your drive, your enthusiasm, and also the numbers and the operations and how it's progressing, but are not following the story, give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox and add you to their watch list, please.
Three things. The streaming music market is the growth market in the music industry. There is no doubt about that. We are at the heart of that market. People who want to build streaming services need a platform to do it on, and we're that platform. Second is maths. You only need to look at the numbers. At a 72% margin, anybody can do the maths as to what turnover needs to grow to cover our bottom line. Once we're through that break-even point, 72 pence in every pound goes to the bottom line, so growth in profit will be exponential. The third is that we're a badly known secret. Because we're a company that's the only people doing what we're doing, we're a little misunderstood. So there is value there. We're an undervalued stock because people really don't understand what we do. Once you've got the message, it's really simple. The maths and the market add up to success for 7Digital.
Marvellous stuff, Simon. Good to chat to you, and hopefully we'll be chatting again in the not too distant
future. Well, I hope so, Justin. Let's not leave it 2 years next time.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Aidan Bishop, founder and chairman of Big Dish. Dish is the ticker there. Aidan, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thank you very much. I'm standing in the Big Dish office in Manila, Philippines, whilst we're doing this podcast.
Wow. And do you know what? I had an image then of the office for some reason being in the shape of a big dish. I don't know why that was. You standing in the middle of the dish, but I don't know why that is.
We're in the old, this is the Stock Exchange building in the central business district of Makati, which is like the business area of Manila. So on the 16th floor, and I'm talking to you looking out over the city of Makati.
Yeah, well, let's explain why you're there, because, Big Dish listed not long back, and so there'll be a few people not aware of what you do. So explain the company, explain the connections to where you are at the moment. Good.
Well, we started life in the Philippines. I've lived here for quite some time, and that's why I'm here right now, and that's why, how we started. Big Dish is all about dynamic pricing. So if you think about the airline industry, dynamic pricing or yield management or revenue management, it transformed the way airline seats are sold. The hotel industry as well, it transformed the way the hotel rooms were sold. And what we are doing at Big Dish is looking to bring yield management to the restaurant industry. Dynamic pricing. Times for the same product. So what we're basically doing is our proposition to a restaurant is that empty tables make no money. And there are many quiet times of day, and even in busy times of day, there are still empty tables. And Big Dish wants to drive traffic and fill those empty tables.
Yeah, listen, and you've generated a lot of interest on social media. I've had a couple of people pinging me and saying, well done on the podcast, sounds very interesting, and sending me information. And for a newly listed company, I suppose and it didn't hit me when you first came on, but I thought you were in a very hot sector. It's like, because there have been other companies like Just Eat, for example, have disrupted that space with takeaways, and it went from nothing to a multi-billion pound company. And I asked my wife, I said, look at this app. And I said, obviously it's not launched in the UK yet, but you are going to be doing that. But I said, it's a no-brainer, really, for the user, for the consumer at home, because it doesn't cost me anything to download the app, and it doesn't cost me anything to look for restaurants doing cheap deals, but it saves me money. And I suppose for the business, they wouldn't fill the table. I mean, they only pay you when they get a booking, so it's a no-brainer for them, really, isn't it?
Yeah, look, I've been absolutely amazed since the IPO. The response that we've had has just been absolutely fantastic. And I think you just hit the nail on the head there, is everybody sort of gets it, is that everybody likes to eat out and everybody likes to have a deal. It's a no-brainer. It's something that somebody can really easily understand. Even today, I booked a Big Dish table in a Japanese restaurant not too far from our office, and it was 12 o'clock. It was the beginning of the lunch hour. And I noticed over the hour that we were eating that the capacity filled up but never went beyond 60%. So the fact that we were there just proves the point that yield management works. We can bring more diners to restaurants, and everybody wins. It's a win-win. The consumer wins, the restaurant wins, and Big Dish wins.
Okay, so In recent news is the acquisition of Lulu. Take us through that, the details of that. What is Lulu? And take us through that, if you could, Aidan.
Well, Lulu was one of the early tech startups in the Philippines. It would best be described as like the TripAdvisor of the Philippines. So it's got thousands of restaurants and places, and it's built up a loyal community of followers where people discover great places to eat and leave reviews and so forth. And it's pretty big. I mean, there's 500,000 people a month look at Lulu. It's got a couple of 100,000 people have downloaded and used the Lulu app, and there's over 300,000 reviews left on there. So it is a leading discovery platform in the country. So it's a little different from what Big Dish do. Big Dish is all about yield management, dynamic pricing. What Lulu is about discovery. About discovery and reviews. So the reason we've acquired Lulu is to look at opportunities of how the large Lulu community can really boost the Big Dish business.
Excellent stuff. And as far as so you've taken this over now, and over in the UK there, I mean, are you leading? Is your model leading over there, and you're sort of almost going to be replicating that over here?
Well, we're not looking to replicate the Lulu business in the UK. I mean, we announced last week about our plans for the UK. We're soft launching in Bath in September. Of course, we've acquired Table Pouncer, which is probably the world's first yield management platform for restaurants. And they operate, of course, in Bournemouth, extremely successful. Over 120,000 people a year seated in Bournemouth. And that was the reason why we did that acquisition. So, yeah, we're pretty excited about it. The first step, of course, is the Bath launch. And then after that, we will migrate all of the restaurants in Bournemouth onto the Big Dish app, at which point Table Pouncer in the UK would be completely rebranded as Big Dish.
Yeah. And just going back to Lulu, so just explain this integration and how it'll, you know, help you going forward.
Well, so if you can imagine, you've got 500,000 people in the Philippines that are looking at Lulu every month.
Yeah.
They're looking to discover restaurants. So the opportunity for us, I mean, initially, is to just put on the thousands and thousands of web pages that Lulu is now a Big Dish company. So this will enhance the brand image of Big Dish, and it will drive more traffic to us. It will increase downloads. It will increase diners, and it will benefit us that way. But going beyond that, there's lots more opportunities. For example, we can make Big Dish partner restaurants easily identifiable within Lulu. We could even go look at how we could integrate the Big Dish booking platform into the 200,000 app users that Lulu has. And one of the things Lulu also does that we're pretty interested in is they do events at restaurants called rendezvous, where they invite all their top reviewers to come and eat the food at the restaurant, and then they start putting out on social media, on the Lulu platform, all kinds of reviews, and get people excited and drive traffic to the restaurant. So these are some more things that we can do to add value to Big Dish restaurant partners. And so it was sort of a no-brainer. And on top of that, it was such a low cash burn that Lulu has, and it's basically almost a break-even business. So it was just a no-brainer of an acquisition for us.
Yeah, exactly. And so it absolutely works on so many levels. And but in the UK, I mean, how will you get out and about? How will you get your word out like that? Do you have that kind of strategy over here in some way?
Well, I'll tell you, in terms of the UK strategy, so we look at what Table Pouncer has accomplished in Bournemouth, a city of 200,000 people, yet 120,000 people, that's 10,000 people per month, are dining in Bournemouth via Table Pouncer. And so they've completely dominated the city, effectively. And so we want to be able to replicate that rapidly around the UK, beginning with Bath, of course, with our soft launch. And so we are entering towns and cities, small towns, provincial areas initially, that do not have, where there's very, very limited competition. So we should be able to gain a dominant position pretty quickly in these places and, you know, rapidly grow around the UK.
Yeah, absolutely. And so it works that when a restaurant, obviously affiliated with, signed a contract with books, you get a certain percentage of that booking per head. Is that right?
No. That be more like a voucher or a Groupon type of deal. The way it works is very simple, that a user will come onto Big Dish, and within three taps, he's made his booking at the restaurant. He then shows up at the restaurant and orders his food like he normally does, and when the bill comes, the discount is applied to the bill. That's the consumer side. Mm-hmm. What Big Dish get is a small fee per head for every person that we seat through the app.
Okay. All right. And
it's a proven type of model in terms of the reservation model on a charge on a per head basis, and that varies based upon the type of price points within a restaurant.
Okay, I understand. And as yet, have you disclosed any kind of numbers or user figures you're achieving?
I mean, we've talked about some of the numbers of restaurants that we've got. We've talked about some of the user figures in the UK. We've talked around it about Lulu. We've talked about some of the growth we've been experiencing in Asia. I mean, really, at this point in our life is, we are, I guess, the most effective metric to use is, will Big Dish disrupt the food tech space and bring dynamic pricing as like a main staple to the restaurant strategy? And that's what we're looking to do. And so far, across Asia, we've got about 500 or so restaurants, I believe, and it's growing. And of course, in Bournemouth, there's about 100 or so on Table Pouncer. And we'll be kicking off next month in Bath.
Yeah, yeah. How do you get, you know, I mean, it starts, I suppose, with the restaurant. So is it a case of just getting people, how do you connect with the restaurants? How does that work?
Well, so what we do in Asia, and as what Table Pouncer do, is they have a business development person, and they literally make contact with the restaurants.
Yeah.
And, you know, ask to meet with them or talk to them on the phone and, you know, discuss their marketing strategies and talk about how Big Dish's dynamic pricing strategy can benefit them. And that's how it goes from there. It's quite easy. It's sort of very risk-free for a restaurant because it doesn't cost them anything if nobody shows up. So,
Exactly. The cost is having an empty table, isn't it? That's the cost to them. So, and filling that table is obviously a benefit, even if a little bit goes towards somebody else. So that is, of course, it's a no-brainer for them, isn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
Excellent. And what's your ambition here, Aidan, for the app? Well, you know, where do you intend to be? Like you say, you are in different parts of the world at the moment, but in UK and of course at Far East. What's the ambition?
I think, you know, the current ambition is really to further develop our tech. We've got lots of ideas, lots of things we want to do on that, which is some exciting stuff to be announced, you know, progressively as we, you know, define our plans with regards to our tech development and also around just really growing our Asian business. We're really excited about the UK. We think that's going to be an absolutely huge market for us. I mean, longer term ambitions from that, well, let's just see what happens. I mean, we've got one step at a time. You only just got listed the week before last.
No, exactly. And you're busy and you're gaining traction, you know. Well, Aidan, one final thing to do. If someone's listening to this right now, likes the story, likes what you're doing, but are not following it, please give three reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox and add you to their watch list, please.
Well, I think if people like, you know, disruptive technology, obviously it's speculative, it's high risk, it's high growth, it's all very exciting. But if people are interested in disruptive consumer tech and the food tech space is incredibly hot, then Big Dish is definitely one that people should keep an eye on.
Thanks very much, Aidan. Hopefully chatting very soon. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Simon Stillwell, CEO of Bonhill Group. That's B-O-N-H, ticker. Simon, thanks for joining me.
Good morning.
Now, I assume, have you been reinvented today, a brand new name, a change of direction. I assume not many people will know what you're up to. Of course, you do very well. So for people who are listening to the podcast right now, Simon, give them a brief summary as to what Bonhill Group is all about, please.
So Bonhill Group is the new name for a long quoted AIM business called Vitesse Media. Mm-hmm. I took over running Vitesse a year ago, and during the course of that year, I've changed the management team, changed the board, changed the direction of the company, have refinanced it, and for the last few months we've been working on an acquisition which we've just completed, and that is the acquisition of Investment News in the US, which is the market leading provider of financial information for the financial advisory community out there. So it would be similar to something like Investment Week in the UK, but it's about six times bigger. So it's a fantastic asset, and delighted to have completed the acquisition, and that has triggered the change of name.
Yes, and so that is very interesting. So Investment News, and why in the year? What's your background then? So take us into your background and why you've been looking into this and why the US?
Well, so I worked in the city for 23 years. Mm-hmm. I worked at a couple of brokers, Beeson Gregory, Colin Stewart, and then I co-founded a business called Liberum, an investment bank, back in 2007. And I was chief executive of that up until 2015. But I always liked the provision of financial information, whether that was data or research. And so having left there, having taken a nice couple of years off, I was looking at coming back and starting something that was based around business information, data products, data sets, and live events. And Vitesse was a shell that was doing some of those. It had a very successful women in series, women in finance, women in IT, some live events. But really, this acquisition was about bringing a much bigger business in, so getting some scale into the business, getting some profit and some cash. And although it's in the US, it's the biggest B2B market in the world, it's the biggest financial services market in the world, and we just happen to be able to purchase the market-leading brand in that space. And we will use that as a platform to extend the product offering both in the US and also into Europe and also to Asia. So this is kind of step one in a much bigger plan.
Yeah, and so how much do you buy that business for? How much are you raising money today as well?
Yeah, so we completed a fundraising about 3 weeks ago. It was subject to a general meeting, which got approval last night, and we paid $27.1 million dollars for the business. That equates to about sort of 5.6 times EBITDA in this current year, and we did a £19.5 million fundraise. And also the vendor has been left with a just short of 11% holding and a small loan note. So that was how the business was funded.
Yeah. And so take us into the business. Where does it get revenue from? And what kind of bits of areas? Is it in live events as well as?
Yes, it is. Yeah. So its revenue is about $18 million. Historically, it's generated about a 30% operating margin, and currently 80% of the revenue comes from business information, and that's a mixture of print, so it does a weekly publication, and also digital. So again, about half and half of those revenues come from the print and the digital side. And then the big opportunity for us is that it's got a very small events business, and around about 10% of the revenues come from events. And we believe there's a big opportunity to develop the event portfolio. Normally, with this sort of company, you would expect there to be sort of 40, nearly 50% of the revenues to come from live events. But historically, it's not an area they focused on, and it's something that we think we can develop within the business. And then it's also got some data products. So it does a big industry benchmarking survey. And again, we think we can develop and build and expand the data portfolio as well. So plenty of growth plans for us.
Yeah, absolutely. And you say it's US based, and you've got plans to grow it. I mean, is that not only in the US but geographically as well over here and everywhere else?
Yeah, so the plan is very much to grow the US asset. I think one of the great benefits of having a market leading property is to be able to use that brand to develop things. So first point is to develop that. We already have some existing event activities in the US with our Women in IT and Investor All Stars series. So we've now got a sort of a local base to run those. And then the other areas we're looking for would be to develop our events both in our business information into Asia, and then to develop on what we've got in the UK, because we've already got some smaller assets in the UK. So we currently run What Investment magazine, and we've got Growth Company Investor, we run the Quota Company Awards. So we've got some good financial properties in the UK, and we would look to develop those as well.
So I assume with your background then, Simon, you've got a good ear and a good eye for an investment, haven't you?
I can always surprise myself, but it's been really interesting moving from the advisory side into the PLC side, and I think as I say, it's just very interesting to see the dynamic from this side, from the operator side.
Yeah, absolutely. And but essentially, you see plenty of potential here.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, we, as a management team, we've committed reasonable sums of money to to this. You know, we've all invested, and we all think there's a big opportunity to develop a business. And you know, I think there's. I mean, I took Libram from startup to 55 odd million of revenues, 170 people, profitable every year. And I think the opportunity in this particular vehicle in Bond Hill is greater, not least of all because we're not facing the same regulatory headwinds that that investment banking had. And I think the opportunity is bigger here. And as I say, you know, we're starting off with a US market leading asset.
Yeah, yeah. And so the market capitalization at the moment, I'm trying, is
about 27.5 million. Yeah, 28 million. Yeah.
Okay, marvelous stuff. Okay, and so ideally, you know, let's say looking in 12 months' time, what would you, where would you like to be at?
Well, I think if we can have moved on again in terms of either through acquisition or the organic development of the business in a year's time, and I would expect to see quite a big increase in the event activity that the company is undertaking. I would expect our women in series to have moved from UK, America into Asia and become maybe another continent. So that becomes very much a global series. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to see the first of our data products, either something which is currently in the portfolio that just hasn't been properly packaged, or a new data set that we think will be of value to the financial advisor community. So, you know, that I think that over the course of the year, those three things will be good to have achieved.
Marvellous stuff. Okay. Well, if someone's listening to this, likes the sound of you, your background and the project and the business, but of course they're not following because it's brand new, readmitted today, give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on Bond Hill Group. That's BONH on your page on Vox, and add you to their watch list, please, Simon.
Well, firstly, it's developed the investment news brand. It's, as I say, 20-year market leader, but it's still got bags of potential, and I think we'll diversify the revenues from pure business information and develop those higher-margin events and data products. Secondly, we have got the market-leading diversity franchise with our Women in IT and Women in Finance series, and I think we'll be going to take that on a global basis, and there's no doubt there's an enormous opportunity to address this gender diversity issue. And the final thing is that this is a vehicle that we've all got involved in to grow, and I think there'll be more developments, faster growth through acquisition, but also plenty of growth through the organic channel as well. So there's a lot to do. We've kind of waited a long time to get hold of this asset, and now we've got it, we're going to work extremely hard to develop it.
Excellent stuff, Simon. Good to chat to you, and hopefully you'll be chatting again in the not too distant future. Thanks very much.
Yeah, my pleasure. Speak to you soon.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Russ Mould, Investment Director at stockbroker AJ Bell. You're right, Russ.
I'm very well, Justin. How are you?
Good, thanks. In fact, quickly, when I said that, Russ Mould at AJ Bell. Mm. So AJ Bell, who is that? Are they still around?
Yes, I'd like to think so. Yes,
I don't know who they are. I don't know.
I see what you mean. Oh no, we're a platform. We administer over £40 billion of customer assets, financial advisors.
No, I mean the founder AJ Bell as a person.
Oh, Mr. Bell.
Yes.
Yeah, Mr. Andy Bell. He's the chief executive.
I still Yeah, he's done well, isn't he?
And he still owns about a third of the shares.
Wow. Well, so he's doing very well for himself, I assume. Very sure.
He's in the Sunday Times Rich List. Not that he would thank me for telling people that.
Okay.
He's a very unassuming, down-to-earth guy.
Yeah, that's good. Okay. No, I just wanted to... I mentioned your name, then I mentioned AJ Bell. I realised that is another name, not just a company. And I thought, I wonder if the Mr. Bell is still around.
No, you go to the company website, he's there in all of his glory, Mr. Bell. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. I will have a look at
investing.
That. Oh, in fact,
what's it all about?
I've got a video playing now that's probably coming up on your channel. Okay, anyway, that was on your website there. All right, so Russ, let's talk about, because you've got a massive macro brain and a massive micro brain, if that makes sense, data-wise I'm talking, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But it's been, the market's been quite volatile this week, and,
yep.
You know, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's down to sort of, it's increasing rhetoric, Turkey as well, your Turkey, it's all Trump-centric, yep. It seems to be stemming from Trump is creating these ripples, there's a problem. I know it started sort of politically in Turkey, but they've been having a hammer in, but we had a bounce through yesterday on the Dow because apparently low-level talks are going to restart between China and America next week. So, take us, what's going on? Is this what I want to know is, do you think this is a threat to the global growth? Because oil prices are down, copper's taken a hammering, and those are good barometers, aren't they, of global sort of growth?
They are, very much. I mean, so on the Trump theme, yeah, he's got a big part to play in current market concerns. As I think we've discussed before, markets don't like the idea of a trade war and tariffs, because if you're putting tariffs on things, you're making them more expensive. If you're putting tariff on things, then you're interrupting global trade flow. And if you're interrupting global trade flow, then the chances are that global growth might not come out as strong as expected. Now, at the minute, the US is outperforming everybody economically. Now, Trump tax cuts have got a huge part to do with that. So there's that man again. But there is a gathering question. You know, everybody else seems to be sort of lumping along as best they can, but not doing anything brilliant. Can America continue to grow that fast when everybody else isn't, is one of the key questions that's going to be answered over the next 12 to 18 months. But yeah, Trump's had a huge say with the tariffs on China. Tariffs on Turkey were kind of a bit of a tipping point, I think, as much as anything else. There's been trouble potentially brewing in Turkey for some time. Mm-hmm. It's been running a huge current account deficit. The budget deficit isn't too bad, in fairness, but the economy's been running incredibly hot, and President Erdogan has been politely suggesting to the Central Bank of Turkey that it doesn't raise interest rates too quickly because he wants growth to continue.
Yeah.
And then when last year President Erdogan described interest rates as the mother of all evil, I think a few people began to pay attention and wonder, all this money that he's been lent, would they necessarily get it back in its entirety, or at least would they get all of their coupons? And I think once the Turkish lira began to go down when interest rates weren't going up as quickly as maybe monetary policy orthodoxy would suggest, that's when the panic set in. Because, you know, if interest rates aren't going up and Erdogan doesn't want to support things that way around, then he's got very few options left to him. You know, if you want to cool the economy down, which is the key problem, interest rates he's not going to do. Fiscal austerity doesn't seem that keen. Devalue, well, you know, to help your way out of the, it doesn't help with the debt problems. Or you can impose capital controls and just actually you're not allowed to get your money out. And clearly that was one or two commentators, Mark Mobius, for example, of ex of Templeton Emerging Markets and an emerging market investment legend. He began to suggest that Turkey may go down the path that some of the Asian nations did in 1997-98. Mm. And we all know that everybody thought back in 97, Malaysia devalue was its currency. So what? Within 12 months, Russia had defaulted. There'd been a hedge fund go down. The Fed had bailed it out for $3.6 billion. And you'd had a mini bear market in the UK that lasted about 6 months when the FTSE All Share went down by a quarter amid global growth fears. So everything is interconnected. And I think that has made people worry. So I think then the question is, well, why did the dollar go up in the first place? Some of that may be Trump talk. Some of it because the US economy is going up strongly, but also the Federal Reserve is raising interest rates. The Federal Reserve is withdrawing quantitative easing. It's not stopped adding to it like the UK. It's not slowed down the additions like Europe, and it's certainly not going at it pell-mell like Japan and Switzerland still are. The Fed is withdrawing liquidity. Now, at a time when global emerging markets have probably, according to the Bank of International Settlements, got $4 trillion worth of dollar liabilities, the fact that the world has now got fewer dollars to play with means that paying back those dollar reserve debts is more difficult, and that is an issue. So you're starting to see the withdrawal of quantitative easing, the cheap money that we've all become accustomed to over the last 10 years, the tide on which all markets and asset classes have generally risen, that tide might be starting to go out. And that's why, if you're looking for a narrative, cryptocurrencies blew up first, low volatility strategies blew up second, or let's all short the VIX and da 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 da. Emerging market currencies have begun to wobble. Now you've come a little bit nearer to home with Turkey. As there's less dollar liquidity around, people maybe are having to become a little bit less risk averse, a little bit less pro-risk, and you're starting to see the risky, more peripheral areas of the market just start to topple like dominoes. Yeah. So you've got a really big challenge coming up now. The Fed is determined to start to keep reducing. The ECB is going to stop adding in December. So that really easy money that's helped markets rise isn't going to be around in anything like the quantity that you've got come Christmas, certainly. So this is a big challenge, and Turkey is a key litmus test. Now, where does Turkey go from here? If it's not going to raise interest rates and it's not going to go for capital controls, as the finance minister said yesterday, it's going to dabble with some fiscal austerity, but also it'll be looking for alternative sources of funding. Qatar's offered it $15 billion. It's talking to Germany and France. It could go down the Russia-China route. It won't go to the IMF because that's dominated by America. So, and they're in daggers drawn with them at the minute. And also they won't go to the IMF because the IMF supervised the Turkish economic crisis from 1998 to 2001 in classic IMF fashion. jacked up interest rates, cut government spending, deep recession, and so it was a long, painful adjustment. President Erdogan, as he is now, founded the Justice and Development Party in 2001, was elected Prime Minister in 2002 as a protest against the IMF policies. So I can't personally see him necessarily now going to go back and say all the Turks who voted for him and say, actually, that was a really good idea after all.
Can't see.
So I think the Turkish lira has rallied a bit this week because Turkey's come up with a plan, but I'm not sure we're out of the woods yet. It's still got a high current account deficit. It's still got an overheating economy, and it's still got too much dollar debt.
What I'm concerned about, in a way, not so much concern, but I think once you get one or two red flags and people start becoming more risk averse, it has a psychological domino effect, doesn't it? And and then people start investing less, and of course, growth doesn't come off the back of that. Growth starts to slow down. Self-fueling. People say, "Oh, look, growth is slowing down." And then we've had this talk about, you know, a 2020 recession. It almost becomes self-fulfilling, doesn't it?
It's interesting. Capital Economics, who are no dummies, have actually just put out a forecast saying they think the Fed will start cutting interest rates in 2020. So they are of the opinion that the Fed won't, that the US won't be able to keep outgrowing the rest of the world on a sustainable basis, and that there'll have to be a monetary policy response. And I guess that's one of the reasons why, you know, the yield curve's flattening, in that the yield on 2-year US bonds is now very, very close to the yield on 10-year US bonds. The premium you're getting for that extra time and that extra risk is very, very small, which is the market's way of saying, we think the Fed's going to keep on cutting interest rates in the short term because the economy is running hot. But at some time in the not too distant future, it's going to actually have to start cutting rates because the economy isn't strong enough to withstand the withdrawal of QE, to withstand the higher cost of borrowing. And I think that's the key debate now.
Yeah. Marvellous stuff. Okay, well, do you know, I said that for the last couple of weekends, and the weekend podcast, I chat with a couple of mates, and we talk about our own stocks, our own book, pretty much. But I've said, you know, you've got to start to be a bit careful now. We're in one of the longest bull markets ever, and even, you know, everything does, in the end, revert to mean, pretty much. You know?
Yes, and, I mean, I had lunch with a long-standing colleague the other day, and he reminded me of Fred Schwed's book. Now, Fred Schwed was a broker in the 1920s. He saw the 1920s boom. The book is called Where Are the Customers' Yachts? Because the question was, hang on a minute, the idea of financial advice is to make your clients rich. Well, how come all the brokers have got yachts and all the clients haven't? Which I guess is an interesting question. Yeah. And one of the things that I remember reading it many years ago, and the phrase resonates, as Fred Schwed wrote, booms go boom.
Yeah.
Eventually.
Yeah.
Tricky, of course, is you never know when, right?
But this is how I see it. I genuinely do see it. That I see every recession as an opportunity because you can get...
So does Mr. Buffett.
Yeah, you can do very well out of the back of a recession. When you get a recovery and very aggressive stock re-rating, because everything, like we all know, it's like a pendulum effect, and I always come back to this, you know, things get oversold and then things get overbought.
There you go. That's what makes a market.
Yeah, exactly. Once the bottom is in, pretty much, and people say, well, hang on a sec, we've gone too far. It's fear and greed, isn't it? People don't want to miss out on it. People don't want to be caught, you know, holding their bathwater or the baby, and then they don't want to be caught missing out on a good
bargain. Sitting in the cold bathwater.
Exactly. They want to bargain. Everyone loves a bargain. They're like, oh, this is cheap now. Let's get back in. So that aggressive re-rate is very good. And I've been investing sort of actively for the last 20 years, and I've been through a couple of them. I'm doing better now than ever done. So it never take, unless you're completely stupid, it's, you know, you should never take you out. It should be an opportunity, but you should always invest, you know, conservatively.
That's the secret. You've got to build a portfolio. Volatility is not your enemy. Volatility is your friend.
Yeah.
Volatility is a chance to sell expensively if you want, or at least buy cheaply. But you need to you're going to get some lumps and bumps. So you need to have a portfolio that's built to enable you to get through the volatility safely to the other side. Because then you're not forced to sell at the bottom.
Because
that's what can often happen is, oh my goodness, you know, I mean, fund managers don't like selling at the bottom. But why do they have to sell? Because their customers are ringing them up saying, I don't want money in your fund anymore. Yeah. So this is the problem. So then they're forced sellers. People's financial circumstances may just mean they have to sell because they're relying on profits or dividends from stocks, and in a bear market, they don't come through, and that's when they need the ready cash. And so what you need to do is build a portfolio that means you've got some downside protection and something trickling in at all times so that you're not forced to sell at the worst possible time, which is when everything's on its backside. It's not as easy as it sounds, but it can be done with a balance, you know, the old cliche, a fairly balanced portfolio.
Yeah, it's counterintuitive. Like going back to Warren Buffett, he says, you know, you've got to buy when others are fearful and sell when others are greedy. And it does like that. And I often say, if you're looking at a company and, you know, you've researched it, you like it a lot, and you bought some, and it's dropped because the general market has dropped, you know, for a sort of little correction or something, or it's gone down, and the story hasn't changed, why wouldn't you buy more? As long as you're not overexposing yourself, because the story's got better, it's got more value in there. You know, you
can it's cheaper. Yeah, exactly. You know? If you think the company's still going to be there, it's going to generate the same amount of cash flow, and you're paying a lower price for it.
Yeah, exactly.
Of course, that's when you should be buying more.
Yeah, I mean, if someone, you know, if your favourite sort of you know, trainers or food or anything got reduced by 20%, you'd buy more of it. But on the stock market,
you
people
would
just run away. Anyway, let's go into three stocks quickly.
Pressure Technologies, one we've not looked at before, and two that we have with varying degrees of success, Trufin and Stock Spirits.
Okay, Pressure Technologies. What's the ticker there?
Sheffield's finest. It's got a market cap of around 20 odd million pounds. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is real small cap territory, okay? It's not making any money. The dividend was cut to zero 2 years ago. One of the founders and CEOs just retired. And frankly, the chart goes from top left to bottom right. So this is high risk, potentially high return stuff. The shares are at 120p right now. They've been as high as, I think, £6 or £7 in the past. Right. So, you know, this is at least in, you know, if you're a contrarian, fine. But again, we all know with these turnaround plays, they can take a lot longer to turn around than you think, or indeed at all. The big problem for the company, it makes high precision pressure management systems, steel tubes, for example, things that, for example, keep oil rigs afloat. So it's high tech stuff. They work in the biogas industry, but at one stage, oil customers were 3/4 of the business. So when the oil price went south, the business went south. And they've gone from a net cash balance sheet to a net debt one because of some losses and also a couple of acquisitions. So what you've now got here, it's looking pretty bleak. The company's obviously has done some efficiency work. It's actually sold a business, Hydrotron, to lower some of its oil industry exposure. And it's now basically poised and waiting for a turnaround in orders. Now, if you look at the company's overall profit margins, I mean, at the peak, it was capable of making earnings per share of around nearly 40 odd pence, and the share price is 120. Now, it does need to get to the peak, therefore, for the shares to be cheap. On a mid-cycle basis, say a mid-cycle operating margin of 12%, you're still going to get 15 to 20p of earnings and a stock that looks incredibly cheap. The thing is it going to happen? And if so, when? So the good news is there is some debt on the balance sheet. The good news is the banks have just pushed out any need to repay till 2020. So they're being very, very supportive, very, very patient. So there's no clock ticking necessarily, at least for a couple of years. So in that respect, it's now a matter of if do these orders come back? Because if they do, the company's operationally geared, profits will recover very quickly, as we've seen in previous cycles, and the shares will look very cheap. Equally, if the orders don't come through, then the shares could well continue going from top left to bottom right, given that in the end, it is still making losses. So it's high risk, potentially high return, definitely not for one for widows and orphans, though one for those who are prepared to speculate, to accumulate, and are willing and able to withstand losses.
Yeah, but do you know what? It's a messy chart. It's really
horrid. One that even a mother couldn't love.
Yeah, it's
that ugly.
It's up and down, but it is towards the bottom of the range at the moment. So at least, you know, it could be worse. I mean, so if it's bouncing, it is bouncing off that pound level, you know. So we'll see. 124
we'll
at the moment. Marvellous. Anything else for us?
Now another pig ugly chart for you is Stock Spirits, an Eastern European vodka and spirits maker. You know, we first looked at it in March 17 at 183p. It rocketed to £3.10, and now it's back at £2. And for the last year, the chart has been going again, top left to bottom right. Now, the big problem was the company started losing market share in its core Polish market in a price dust-up, which, let's face it, is never a good thing for any company. The first half numbers looked okay to me. They've just come out. Revenue's up 5, operating profit up 10, dividend up 5, net debt down. Poland have gained a little bit of market share back, though pricing is still very fierce. Italian market is still tricky in the Czech Republic. It's an awful chart. If anything now, I think it's being kicked about because people have fallen out of love with emerging markets. Mm-hmm. We've just talked about Turkey. The MSCI Emerging Market Index is in a bear market. It's down by more than a fifth from its high. But you've got a stock here, 14 times earnings, 3.5% dividend yield, trading on a near 50% discount to the major international drinks groups like Diageo and Pernod Ricard. The dividend yield means you're being paid to wait. They're fighting back in Poland. The chart is obviously telling me I'm missing something. So I am scratching my head and I'm slightly worried. Still got a profit from when we first looked at it. I'm going to tough it out, but I must admit, I would like to see that chart start to stabilise.
Yeah, I mean, do you know what? It's round figures, it's heading towards that £2. It had a little bounce off it, but I don't know. It seems like it's quite an aggressive downtrend at the moment.
It is, I know, and I'm looking at it. I've looked at the numbers. I can't see anything in them that would make me think something's not right there. The market's telling me I'm missing something. Maybe it's just emerging market fears. But you know, at the moment, I'm going to stuff it out. Once it gets down to my in price level, I might reconsider.
Yeah, it needs to stabilise that share price there, because it's not at the moment. It looks like it's under that 200-day moving average, moving down sharply. So we'll see.
But again, the balance sheet's fine. There's a dividend yield there, so the clock's not ticking. So we can afford to. Hopefully, we can afford to tough it out.
Yeah, cool. What's the last one, Russ? The
last one, Trufin, really quickly. Complex financial services business. IPO'd in February 18, market cap of just over £200 million. I mean, we looked at it in May at 225p, and it's not really gone anywhere. You remember, it's a complex business. Four parts, forecourt lending, early invoice payments for councils, a cash flow management system for small and medium enterprises, and a 15% stake in peer-to-peer lending firm Zopa. That's just done a fundraising, which is why I'm talking about it now. That's increased the value of the Zopa stake by 8 pence a share at Trufin to 46p a share. They've actually let their stake go down a bit by not participating to 13%. That was one catalyst I was looking for when I mentioned the shares. So that reaffirms there's something there. We're now looking for loan growth in the asset, in the forecourt lending business. And the company's applied to the Prudential Regulatory Authority for a banking license. If it gets that, the cost of its own funding will go down, increasing its margins. Now, this is another very high-risk play. It's a loss-making small cap. They're not for everybody. But there is a lot of potential in the business here. The sum of the parts calculation for the four businesses is very interesting. And management are incentivized up the kazoo to get the share price up. So again, for those who again like to speculate, worth a look. For those who are more risk averse, probably move on, particularly in the current market environment.
Marvellous stuff. Have a nice weekend, Russ.
I will. And you, Justin. Speak soon.
Catch up next week, fella.
I look forward to it.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is John Mayer, mining analyst and partner at SP Angel. You're right, John.
Yes, all good form. Thank you.
Now, we've got an interesting take on that tragedy that happened. The Italian bridge has collapsed, and there's a lot of controversy surrounding that, and the lack of sort of maintenance around that. It's become a political issue right now, but we'll get into that, and because it plays into a mining angle, doesn't it? So we'll play into that. We'll talk about that in a bit, and maybe the people saying the reason why it happened. But before we get into that, Jonas, you did. We were meant to catch up yesterday, but you couldn't catch up. But you mentioned about ARC. There's some good news on ARC Minerals. I know it's very popular. I don't know whole stock in it, but a lot of people said to me, you should get into this company, and I sort of, you know, I like the easy, fast, early move, and I understand it's still a small cap, but that easy, fast, early move from like 2.25 pence to upwards, that's where I should have been in. I feel like if it comes back, I'm definitely interested. But tell us about ARC Minerals, John.
Well, we're still early on in the development of all this at ARC, but they're drilling holes. They've drilled 10 holes so far over at the Zamsort property on the Zambian copper belt. This is very close to the border with the Congo, which is important geologically, location-wise. But the key thing is they three of the drill holes that they've drilled have produced over 80 meters of continuous mineralization. And this is highly metamorphized mineralization. And the reason why that's important is, firstly, 80 meters close to, it's almost from surface, is very good stuff. Now, we're assuming that mineralization has copper in it. It's probably got reasonable amount of cobalt in it as well. I was out there at site just a few weeks ago, and I could see mineralization in the core. I didn't see 80 meters of continuous mineralization, but and let's not underestimate, that's a huge intersection by most standards. What we know from historical records and looking at things is the grade is generally quite good in this project. So it really looks as if they've got a really good quality project in the portfolio here. And we always thought that it had the potential to be good. Now we need to see what the scale of this thing is. And we don't know that yet. I saw two drill holes that were 400 meters apart. They say the rest of these drill holes, I think they're drilling at 300 meters apart. So there should be some scale to this. And the significance of the metamorphized mineralization is that this should be looking more like what we see with the very high-grade deposits in the DRC. Now, the DRC is an expensive and difficult place to work in, and some companies may wish they'd never gone there. Zambia is much more stable, much more sensible as a jurisdiction, much easier for relatively small companies to get up and running in. And this project is not so far away from First Quantum's massive Trident project that they are working on at the moment. So it's, although it's at the end of the copper belt, you can say it's at the end of the line. It's like ending up at Warmington-on-Sea, but it's still reachable. These days you can get lorries in. It's not that difficult. It costs a little bit more, I guess, than going to some of the other mining areas in the copper belt. But we were able to drive round from Lusaka all the way round there in a couple of days. wasn't too difficult. The last 4 hours were on a bit of a bumpy track, but that's very easily upgradable. And I think this looks really good for ARC.
Excellent stuff. ARCM is the ticker. Yeah, no, it's very early on. Do you know what? I hate missing an early fast rise. And this was Nick von Schoenen has been on the podcast a couple of times. I like him a lot. He seems to know his stuff. But it was sort of bouncing around between 2 and 3 pence. And it's one of the stocks I nearly got into. And then all of a sudden it took off and it basically hit 5 pence. So I thought, that there, that's the early fast rise. And I should have been in it because it had good fundamentals and, good sounds around it, good things happening. And I just missed out. And I'm thinking, it's got plenty to go now. Of course it has, because it's still, what, sub 20 million is it, market cap? I mean, plenty of time.
It was 30 million last time I looked. It's still got potential for multiple times upside. Yeah. I mean, I think this should be a 100, 200 million pound stock relatively quickly, because it's got such a, the indication is so promising from a copper perspective. We're not going to get to 200 million pound of value until we know more on the scale and we see verification of the grades that are coming out of this. But assuming that it is a sensible scale and that the grades are something over 0.5% copper, then I think this will have a very good future.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I like to be in the sub 10 million market cap. That's what I like, because I've done a couple of research over the last couple of years of the fastest moving stocks, and they've all started just below, well, not all, I'd say a high percentage of them, around 50% actually, have started sub 10 million market caps. That's what I like to be in, doing research on companies there. And I just didn't have time to research ARC too well, and then they made a move. And I thought, there we are, you can't be on them all. But if it comes back a little bit, I may be interested in that. Anyway, let's move on, John, because you mentioned about this Italian tragedy that happened, the bridge that collapsed. And there is a sort of, a mining take on this, or from the office. What's happening there? What's the chatter then?
Well, engineers are speculating that there's a degree of corrosion involved in this, and that's often known as concrete cancer, where the rebar used in the concrete has started to corrode internally. It's scaled off. It causes bits of concrete to fall away. It gets exposed to the elements, and then it loses a certain amount of the structural integrity and strength. And the way to fix this is to improve the vanadium content in the rebar, the nickel content, and the ferrochrome content perhaps as well. So there are materials to add to steel to improve its corrosion resistance and to improve its strength. The European standard for vanadium in rebar is still lower than that in the United States, and the standard in China is lower again. And engineers and policymakers from around the world will look at what's happened in Italy and will say, well, let's do something about this, and let's improve the quality of the materials that are going into these bridges to make sure this kind of thing doesn't happen again, because there's an awful lot of infrastructure being built and being replaced around the world, and it needs to be done properly. Otherwise things fall apart, especially if there's any form of tectonic movement or earthquakes. And so it's important to get it right. So I do think one of the consequences of this will be to raise vanadium standards around the world.
Yeah, absolutely. And talking about that, of course, one of your favourites, of course, is in that area, aren't they? I mean, Bushveld.
Yeah, that relates to Bushveld Minerals. They produce around 4 to 5% of global vanadium supply at the moment. And they've got expansion plans to do more, and the demand is there. The Chinese did raise their vanadium standards earlier this year, and I suspect they'll have to raise those standards again because they're still a long way behind the US and the Europeans. And we published a note on that, and I put a chart into this morning's note on just on those vanadium percentages in European, US, and Chinese rebar to remind everybody that that more can be done.
Yeah. And what other plays are there? I mean, apart from Bushveld, are there any other listed plays on vanadium at the moment?
There is another AIM stock. I forget the name. It has a project which is somewhere behind. There are very few vanadium producers to get into. Now, Horizonte published news today on its nickel project in Brazil, and I mean that's of interest because nickel again is good for corrosion resistance in steel, particularly in stainless steel, where you use nickel and ferrochrome together, and they're different grades of stainless steel that companies use. So if there is going to be more construction and reconstruction, then one would expect demand for nickel to improve. Although I think what's really the big driver for nickel and nickel hydroxide in particular is going to be the growth in batteries, battery manufacturing plants, because there's much more weight in a lithium iron battery these days in the nickel component than there is in anything else, because the lithium is light, the graphite's not too heavy, but the nickel is still a heavy metal and still the metal of choice for many of these batteries.
Yeah, I tell you who's involved in it a little bit is we've got a bit of vanadium in there is Jan Garden Mines. I just realised that they've got projects going on there. You should check them out, John. Jan is the name there.
And, I'll have a look.
Yeah, and small cap there. Brian McMaster is the guy in charge, also of Harvest Minerals. But yes, good company there, and worth looking at because they've just gone into they're going to PFS, but scoping study they've just done. I mean, but yes, it's and that's sub 10 million market cap. It's in that sweet spot I like, John.
That's where you like it.
Yeah, I know. Okay, marvelous stuff, John. And listen, have a nice week, and we'll catch up next week, fella.
Look forward to it. Thank you.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Market in the last 24 hours. They are at five, Botswana Diamonds, BOD. At four, Savannah Petroleum. At three, Rehoboth Resources. At two, just talked to Simon earlier, Seven Digital Group. And number one most followed company is SDX Energy. Take it there, SDX. Hopefully we'll get Paul on the podcast soon because another bit of good news came out today. All right, top five most liked RNSs are as follows. At five, Berkeley Energia, issue of shares, performance rights, and Appendix 3B. At four, Kin Group, Bidstack Limited, transaction update. At three, Metal Tiger, holdings in company. At two, Motive Bio, Iclaprim Data, at ESCMID, /ASM conference. And number one, most liked RNS came from SDX Energy, successful production test at SDX 3X well in Egypt. And like I said, hopefully we'll get Paul on very soon. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos apreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.